All right. So it is the 30th of April. I know I have to get the recordings up. Part of it is finding them. Not that I've lost them, but they're on two different devices. I anticipate that will be done the next day or two. Reminder, and I will return to it, discussing it at the end of the night, the end of class, that tomorrow night's final class will be... Sorry, I'm just looking for slides that should be here. All right. My computer's decided. All right, we're going to pause for a second because... Okay, we are back. So tomorrow night's class will be done online at the regular time, 8:20 to 9:35. Although it will be recorded, I would ask that you make every effort to participate online, and I will give you, I will talk about it, but I've also just emailed out by TWEN the instructions. I've also taken a moment to look at the exam that I gave the last time around. It won't be exactly the same this time around because it was only 2 years ago, and I know how good some people's memories may be in passing these things along. But I think the format will be the same. The way I did last exam was that it was two parts. One part gave students a choice of questions to answer. So there were two different questions in that example. I may do two or three. Just so that everyone can pick the one that they think they have the most mastery of. And it's a fact pattern. There are certain tasks required. And the second half actually was marking up an agreement. Giving you very much like what we've done. So giving you an agreement, giving you a fact pattern, and asking you to revise the agreement per the fact pattern. So really trying to help you individually show your understanding of the discussion of the skills that we've learned. It also makes it very easy for me to see all your changes because I can just mark them against the original. So the way it will work is that the exam itself will be posted, what we said, Monday at 9 a.m. is when the first exam starts, is that right?
Yeah.
By Monday at 9 a.m. on our TWEN page, make sure you have access to said TWEN page, it will be in the assignment Dropbox. You will check it out, put in your student number, your exam number. The clock will start. You will have to check it back in, submit your final exam through TWEN, no more than 24 hours from the time you choose to start. Any time between the beginning of exam period and the end of exam period, you will have a 24-hour window of your choice. But if you want to have fully 24 hours, don't go past exactly 24 hours before the end of exams. Yeah.
Do you want us to submit in Word format so that you can use...
Ideally, also so I could actually open your exams, ideally Microsoft Word format would be appreciated.
Somewhat PDF, just... But
PDF is harder for me to mark.
Yeah, it's
going to
be we'll get a great spec quicker.
A couple of... And I know there's at least one Mac odd program that Apple has that makes it very hard to... open up files and read them. Does anyone have a technical issue with submitting in Microsoft Word? I can take open office documents in a stretch, but I'd rather not. Anybody have an issue, technical? Okay, good. I know that Sometimes people have arranged for particular accommodations through the Office of Student Services. I have no idea about that, nor will I, because if I hear that a particular person has and I see that a particular exam number, you know, is not there or whatever, I will know ahead of time. So if you've made those arrangements, whatever the details are, that's what they are. It would be helpful for me if you could indicate if you are a graduating student. I should be getting a list as part of my roster, but it's always good to see that in front because those grades do have to get in early.
So exam numbers, no names?
Exam numbers, no names. Now, the question was asked, he said in good passive voice. The question was asked of me at the end of last class about how I'm going to grade and what will be incorporated into the grades. The exam will be the major, major part. I will give a grade for each exam. There is no curve. If you all do A-plus work, you all get A-pluses. That has not yet been my experience, but I'm happy to be pleasantly surprised. I will have an idea in my own head what things should be in an exam. Since you have 24 hours to do it, I will be looking at some level at your writing, your spelling, at least of the obvious things. If you misspell copyright, W-R-I-T-E, that would be bad. If you say something can be copywritten, that would also be bad. Beyond that, I think what I'm going to do, because I don't generally do the third up, third down, but also everyone really has participated, so that's not a relevant metric. But I will be looking back at your various submissions. And to the extent that I see, particularly in the individual projects, because the group projects are a little bit more difficult to evaluate, but to the extent that I see within your submissions a substantially excellent work above average, or substantially less so, particularly in the later assignments, I may choose then to exercise the third up, third down through those submissions. So they're going to inform my grading, but it's really the final exam that is the major part of your grade. Questions? Okay. Yes, ma'am. I will check. Ordinarily, I would point people to my cyber law exam, which is on file, because my other classes, that tends to be the format. This is different. So I need to go back and see if any of the exams that I have are sufficiently different from the one I want to give now that I can post it. You know, we faculty members are not all that imaginative. And so we tend to at least try to repurpose some of what we've done. Also, other than the last time I taught this class, it wasn't an intermediate skills class, so it wasn't the same level of expectation of written work. I will do what I can to make it possible, but let me just tell you, as for the contract part of it, you know what it's going to be because you've done this already. Here's an agreement. Here's your fact pattern. Mark up this agreement the way you should in order to represent your client per this fact pattern. We've done that, so that's half. The other part will be up.
Question on that. Are we going to have an opportunity to maybe write some sort of memo, a small memo, explaining why we did what we did?
That may be another question.
With regards to the draft.
No, I think I'll have a good enough sense based on the facts that I'm giving you to see what you focused on. I may or may not include and write a note to the client. It's a reasonable question. I have to think about it because I do want this to be something that you can successfully think about and complete in the space of 24 hours while sleeping and eating and doing all those sorts of other things. I'll see, because if I'm in the role of opposing counsel, then no. You know, I have to think about how you're doing this. But the other questions may be, here's a set of facts. Write a memo to the client explaining the issues that you think the client should be concerned with. Or here's a set of facts. What are the potential licensing issues that come up? You know, write an essay about that. That's the sort of question. Real world, fact-based. I'm not going to necessarily ask you for, tell me the theory of. I'm not a theory guy. And that's not been the point of this class. So it's going to be a practical exercise of your understanding. Part of it will be actually marking up an agreement. Other parts may be memo to the client, letter to opposing counsel, draft provisions, those sorts of things. So if I can find examples, I will provide them. But if not, that's pretty much what you're going to see. Any other questions? Yes?
If we have questions, email them to you and the whole class, or just you directly, or not taking questions?
Here's my concern. I am trying to preserve the anonymity of your grading, because that is something on which you rely collectively. If I get an emailed question, it will be fairly clear to me when that question came in versus which exam number. Yeah. It becomes difficult, and I want to be fair about this.
What if we do an Antoine anonymous
thing? Time is... I am open to suggestions on how you can have questions asked and answered. Obviously, if you can... Somebody take a look at TWEN. If there's a way of doing it anonymously with the test number in a way that is effective, let me know, because I haven't done that from your perspective. I'm happy to go with that. As far as what you may use, this is about real world. And the real world is not a closed book exercise. There is, however, one thing you may not use. Anyone else's work. This is not a collaborative exercise. Right? I obviously, because I'm trusting you, have no way of verifying, other than seeing really similar language that may make me suspicious. But I would assume that this is not a concern. So what I'm telling you formally, your own work. No collaboration with any other person in here or otherwise. Any other questions? Yep.
Just with the anonymity thing, Professor Rieger had us, we could create a Gmail account with our exam number.
Why?
We had issues.
Oh. But this time is still... I'm happy, if you could figure out a way of sending me an anonymous question, I'm happy to try to anonymously answer it. But I don't anticipate a whole lot of questions. I hope there should be, and technical issues should be sent to the library or Office of Student Services. Don't ask me, because A, I'll answer them, but B, I will know whose problem it is.
Like I
say, take a look. I have not used TWEN from the student's perspective, so take a look and see what's there, and if you want to point it out to me, somebody, I'm happy to enable what I have to enable. I just don't know. All right? Good. For the penultimate, and that's a good word to know, of course, penultimate means second to last, as much as it's misused. For the penultimate topic, I want to go back to sort of a concept that has under... Did I get this wrong? That underlies there a lot of what we've discussed. And that's the idea of a monopoly. and the idea of a legal versus an illegal monopoly. I think we all understand what a monopoly is generally, other than a Hasbro game. The notion that one party or a limited number of parties have the ability to keep others effectively out of a market to sell something. Monopolies occur. They are part and parcel of a truly free market system. The opportunities exist. And as we've talked about, at least in the Constitution, we have the idea of a limited monopoly in patent and copyright. The whole notion that the creator or inventor should be given a limited time monopoly on his or her creation or invention. That's, and the reason being that you want people to be able to profit. And by allowing them to profit, you incentivize them to do more creation and more inventing, which is good for the economy of any country, but especially one that's trying to establish itself, and that's why it's in the Constitution. So if monopolies are potentially natural occurrences within a free market system, and monopolies are enshrined at least in some way in our Constitution, does that mean that monopolies are legally encouraged as a general matter in the United States? Well, there's sort of something, right? I've got this thing over my shoulder that suggests probably not. And the answer is no. But why not? Why is there a Sherman Antitrust Act? Why is there a Clayton Act, which we've seen in the reading? Why?
Eliminates competition.
What?
Eliminates competition in a free market society.
What does?
Big monopolies.
Okay, so what? So what if it eliminates competition? That's sort of by definition. Monopoly means no one else is selling, therefore there's no competition. So what? We've legislated against them. Why?
Without competition, there's no creativity and there'll be no progress.
Maybe, although that's sort of opposite what the Constitution says, right? That competition can exist where you have multiple creative people. But each of them is given a monopoly in a patent, for example, a limited monopoly. Nobody else is allowed to invent that same thing. And the Constitution enshrines that. So that's not what we're talking about. Why do we have a Sherman Antitrust Act? Why do we have a Clayton Act? Why don't we have the phone company anymore, as we used to? Why don't we have the oil company, as we used to?
It puts consumers at risk in the end, because when you consolidate power over, let's say, a product or something, choices are limited, and it really is against the capitalistic policies of the United States.
No, it isn't.
I don't know.
It's not against capitalism. Capitalism would say, if you have a better product, or more market power that enables you to push others out of the market, capitalism says go for it. But the point is that we have laws that are that regulate the free market, that restrict what otherwise unbridled capitalism. Why? You started with the why, but then you sort of came away from it. Why?
It's not in favor of a consolidation of a market or a product is not in favor of a consumer.
True. Why?
Because it centralizes all of the supply in one area and limits choice.
So what if the choices are worse? What if the market says, this is the one I want?
Then the market makes that decision.
But we don't let unbridled monopolies.
We'll say, like, in the medical field, if only one pharmaceutical company is dominating with a certain medicine, if there's other needs for certain diseases or something, they're going to need variations of medicine. But if they don't have the financial capability, if there's a monopoly over the whole market, then there's not going to be other medicine that's available to the people who need it.
But if the medicine works, why do you care? But again, so someone can invent another medicine, and if it works better, the market says, we'll use that one. What?
Price fixing?
What is price fixing?
Well, if a company has a monopoly, they could pretty much charge $1 billion, and people would have to buy it if it's a necessity, because there's no other competition. So that would be the only way to get it. They could overcharge people and price it.
And that's the answer. And that's the answer. Also, to a certain extent, maybe not pharmaceutical specifically, but there's no push. What does competition do? Competition in the marketplace, A, one of the places that you see competition, especially for commodity goods, is price. One way to compete is on features, is on taste, is on whatever. But if, especially for things that are fairly commoditized, the only place to compete is on price. And the only way, and the reason we want companies to compete on price is that drives prices lower, which is better for consumers because it means they can afford the thing. If you only have one supplier, and that supplier is providing something people need, that supplier can charge anything, as you've said, and people still have to pay it. And that's true not only of end-user retail customers, it's also true of wholesale customers. Businesses that want to sell a product, they make their money, right? The difference between how much they pay for it at wholesale and what they can sell it at retail. But if there's no competition for their business, they've got to go to the single supplier of the wholesale good, then they're not going to be able to push the gap as far as they otherwise might. Competition drives down prices. Competition also theoretically improves quality. You may have seen this, and I have to say I've seen this particularly because it's something that is of a personal interest. When you have a single kosher restaurant in an area, almost certainly that restaurant is mediocre and expensive. And I'm not picking on kosher per se. I've just had this experience. I suspect it's also true of some other kind of special market good. The local health food store, the local whatever. If you've only got one that people want to go to, you're laughing. You
yeah, same situation.
You know, the local kosher place, mediocre and expensive. And what happens when the second one opens? The first one is either going to become better and less expensive, or will go out of business. That's what you see. In the late 19th century, mid to late 19th century, we began to have, first of all, we began to have companies that were big enough to have monopoly power. That we went from local manufacturer to national manufacturer, from individual to automated. The economies of transportation, first of all, the market of transportation itself lent itself to the monopolization. But the economies of transportation allowed single sources to blanket whole swaths of the country. And you had a few very rich people who were able to buy up competitors or temporarily price cut competitors out of business and become monopolies. You saw it in the railroads, and I recognize this is not a history course, but it's important. If you look at the history of the railroad systems in the United States, at the early stages where people were sort of building all sorts of different kinds of railroads and sizes and widths and gauges and tracks, and then we standardized on those, and then you had local lines, and then people started realizing that if you connect the local lines, that you could have one line that's more convenient for people, and then you start building up more lines, and eventually you had, you remember the phrase from middle school, high school, the robber barons. Remember the robber barons? Oil, classic example, Standard Oil. Telecommunications, the American Telephone and Telegraph Company, AT&T. You had a couple of local telephone companies, but very quickly you had one. Good, bad, or indifferent. But particularly if you look at the late 19th century, the anti-consumer issues relating to monopolies started to become starkly clear. And so, in 1890, Senator Sherman, I think it was Senator Sherman, proposed and had adopted the Sherman Antitrust Act. Now, that doesn't mean it was against having faith in people. But a trust is a particular type of business combination. And so we have the Sherman Antitrust Act. Every contract combination in the form of trust or otherwise, or conspiracy, in restraint of trade or commerce among the several states or with foreign nations is declared to be illegal. Why the several states or foreign nations? Why not just declare them all? Why wouldn't a single state monopoly be a problem? Well, might. But who has jurisdiction over a single state monopoly? Not Congress. Congress's jurisdiction is interstate commerce, hence, and also international. So that's why. So it's not saying contracts or combinations or even conspiracies per se are illegal. Right? That, you first start reading this, say, wait, every contract is illegal? No. In restraint of trade or commerce. Every person who shall make any contract or engage in any combination or conspiracy hereby declared to be illegal shall be guilty of a felony. Obviously, that's probably the numbers that were not true when Sherman first drafted this. And section 2, every person who shall monopolize or attempt to monopolize or conspire with any other person or persons to monopolize any part of the trade or commerce among the several states, etc. So we have two separate types of violation. Two separate anti-competitive, anti-consumer activities that were declared illegal. The first is a contract, combination, trust, or conspiracy. By definition, what must one have to have a contract, a combination, or a conspiracy?
Two parties.
At least two parties. So the type of thing this is talking about are when more than one company or more than one person get together collectively to restrain interstate commerce. Two companies that agree to fix their prices. Why should we bother, they think? And again, in a purely free market environment, and if you have two suppliers, they have every financial incentive to go to each other and say, look, you're competing with us. We could have a price war to try to get to the consumers, but we're both going to hurt our profits if we do that. So why don't we do this? Let's keep the prices the same. And you have that side of town, and we'll have this side of town. And the consumers have no choice. And they can't, right? The prices are going to be the same. Or even, we'll keep the prices the same and let the consumers decide, but we're not going to have a price war with you. We're not going to fight you on pricing. Is that okay with you? Sure. Let's keep our profits up there. That was legal, isn't anymore.
So what about Time Warner Cable, for example, who has a monopoly?
What about that, right?
In a lot of areas in New Jersey and Long Island, they're the only cable provider.
That's correct.
Alternative is Dish, but that's not cable.
That's correct. Now, we'll get to some of these examples. Now, keep in mind, that there are certain external factors that might allow, if not monopoly, then limited vendors. Cable is a great example, especially 30 years ago, right? In order to provide cable television service, what did a company have to actually do? What do you need for cable television service? You need cables. You need cables. The amount of time and money and capital investment and just right-of-ways and all sorts of things that a company needs to get in order to be the provider of that service are substantial. The barriers to entry, the external barriers to entry, are substantial. So you couldn't simply just start a cable company. Well, you could, but you know, if you wanted customers, you actually had to string cables. So, to a certain extent, there were barriers to entry. Now, you know, then municipalities had to decide how many companies were they going to allow to access to either the poles or the underground wires. And you did see some limitations. Those are local, right? Within a state, this is not applicable. Those are more state public service commission issues. So for cable television, the initial barrier to entry was physical. Not everybody could string the wires. So the companies that invested, whether it was Cablevision, Time Warner, right? They got in there. They could do it. They had the infrastructure. Notice which other companies, which other types of companies were the first to compete with the cable companies. Well, you have two kinds. One is satellite companies. But in order to have a satellite company, what do you need? A satellite, also very expensive. So that limited some competition. But who competes with Cablevision? What?
Phone companies.
Why was it that Verizon was able to mount a significant challenge for television service? Because they already had the wires. They just had to upgrade their own wires to fiber. Once they could do that, they already had the poles or the right-of-ways, the trucks, right? So what they had to do was once they could upgrade their technology, but of course it goes both ways. So the telephone companies, which itself, right, telephone companies said something. Talk about that. Right. Telephone companies had a boost in trying to compete because they already had the wires. So once their wires could carry enough capacity to carry television signals, which is significant, then they were able to immediately go into that marketplace. The hard part was done. But of course, there's a flip side to that. Right? So the telephone company started competing on cable television, on television service, right? And they already had the wherewithal to provide data services of some kind. Initially, it was ISDN, which was over traditional phone lines. Then you had DSL, and then, you know, all these things. And believe me, I configured all of them in my lifetime. It was not fun. But notice, what was the response of the cable companies? So, okay, phone company, you're competing with us on television? Guess what we're going to compete with you on? Telephone. Optimum voice. Right? Optimum online. You want to do television? No problem. We'll do phone and data. Because now it doesn't matter. All the wires are the wires. It's all IP stuff. I don't mean intellectual property. Right? So, at some level, technology can break down some of those barriers. But there are also these substantial barriers to entry. It's not just this industry. Go start a health insurance company. This is not a minor investment to start a health insurance company. So if you want to know why there are a fairly low number of health insurance companies, it takes a lot of money to start a health insurance company. That's not a legal monopoly issue. It's a barrier to entry issue.
But at the end of the day, within Manhattan, let's say Time Warner Cable, they're losing money and they say, okay, we want to charge our customers an extra $70 a month. All the people in Manhattan are not going to have a choice. They don't have another cable
sure they
company
do.
That's, they have a choice not to have cable or to go to ditch.
No, that's not the only choice anymore in Manhattan because it's taken some time.
The Apple TV and stuff.
But no, it's a question of who's got the wires to the buildings. Time Warner has the wires to the buildings. But so increasingly has Verizon upgraded its connections to the buildings to fiber optic. And once it does that, assuming that the owner of the building, because it's not usually apartment dwellers, right, who make these decisions, if they have the ability at a terrace, maybe they can put up a dish. But otherwise, it's the building. But what has kept Manhattan from having choice is the physical plant, too. They had to upgrade all those wires, and it's harder in Manhattan, to fiber optic. But now, as far as I know, Fios is fairly well available in much of Manhattan now. Right? And certainly in the outer boroughs where it's easier. It's been so once you have the access to it, you have choices. And of course with television you could always just put up an antenna. Now you've got people doing that over the internet, which is another really interesting case. But the idea here is companies too big, either the wholesale buyers are hurt, well, maybe the wholesale buyers are hurt, but ultimately consumers are hurt because their choices go down, which means the ability to force the companies to compete on pricing goes down, and the ability to force the companies to improve the product goes down. And in order to protect the consumer, Congress said, we are going to legislate against this market force. And we are going to make it illegal for two or more entities to get together to restrain trade, restrain commerce. And there are lots of ways that can happen. And we're going to make it illegal for a person, and of course person is a legal person, so it might be an entity, to establish a monopoly in trade or commerce.
This I also never really understood, because if I was to start a business, I want to make the business as successful as possible. And as I started, if it becomes a monopoly, so be it, because I'm the first one to do, let's say, a certain type of business. And
mm-hmm.
What am I going to do? Once I see it reach a certain monopoly level, I have to stop doing what I'm doing in order to increase sales?
No.
Because I'm afraid I'm
no. This is not compete. This is not be first. This is to monopolize.
Right.
Monopolize means taking an active effort to eliminate other competition. Not to be the it's not prohibiting being the first.
What if you're big enough where you're not making an active effort, but your business is just big enough where it's already there and just for your business being there eliminates the other businesses. Like a Walmart, for example, doesn't that eliminate all other businesses?
You know what? At some point, Walmart doesn't. But if Walmart were to buy Target, right? It might. And the short answer to your question is, when they get too big, they get sued and broken up. That's it. There used to be essentially the oil company. It's called Standard Oil. And after this law passed, the federal government sued and forced Standard Oil to break itself up. And so you had bits of Standard Oil that became, that just went to the abbreviation, SO. That became SO, which later became Exxon, right? And then there are others that have, other the oil companies we know today, many of them began as regional parts of Standard Oil, and it was broken up. And the same was true, I guess it was the 1970s, that the Justice Department sued to break up the phone company. When I was a Ute, in the early 1970s, there was a phone company. Local, long distance. AT&T was the phone company. That was it. And you didn't own your telephone. You leased it. And whatever the service was, it was. And whatever the rates were, they were. And other companies could not, because they could not get into the house, right? They weren't able to get to the lines. And if people wanted to sell better telephones with more features, there was no way to do that because people didn't buy phones. And so the government broke up the phone company into what were deemed the regional Bell operating companies, the RBOCs. You'll see that, RBOC. If you hear some telecom guy talk or person talk about the RBOCs, it's not talking about a snake Pokemon, which, by the way, is Cobra backwards. That's why Ekans and Arbok are named that. If you haven't looked at Pokemon lately, there it goes. But no, regional Bell operating companies. So you had New York Telephone, and you had Bell Atlantic, and you had Southwestern Bell, and so on, Pacific Bell. You've heard these names, right? They didn't exist. They were all one big, happy Ma Bell. And you go back, you watch Mad Men, maybe you'll see references to Ma Bell.
That's Beastie Boys.
What?
Beastie Boys on Ill Communications. Yeah, anyway,
okay.
90s, 20 years later.
But you know what? It didn't work. Because then you had recombination. So New York Telephone became 9X. 9X merged with Bell Atlantic, which sort of then merged more to become Verizon. So you had the recombining, Southwestern Bell, Pacific Bell. They bought up a lot of the smaller providers. But what that did do was allow other companies entirely to compete. So you had the Southern Pacific Railway. You don't think about the Southern Pacific Railway much. But did you know that the Southern Pacific Railway had a lot of tracks and a lot of rights of way, and they needed to communicate across that nationwide railroad network? So they had fiber optic lines. They had telecom lines that were completely and utterly underused. And they had all these rights of way to lay wires. And they say, you know what? We've got this telecom system, and the railroad business isn't doing so well. We've got all these rights of way. What if we turned ourselves into a phone company? SPR. Became Sprint. Sprint arose from the Southern Pacific Railway, I think. That's what I recall. If I'm wrong, I apologize. Similarly, MCI arose. They could not get into the market until the single company was broken up. It doesn't happen very often. It doesn't happen very often. What's more likely to happen is this.
Something that I found that phone thing interesting. If when there was AT&T and they were leasing the hardware, the phones to you, were they making their own phones or did they buy all their phones from a supplier?
As far as I know, they made everything, right?
It was all in-
they invented stuff in Bell Labs, which then became Lucent, which then failed. But I know because I invested at the wrong time. You don't really think about these things. So, but what we do see, and this is where we start getting today, our connection back to intellectual property and licensing. I wasn't going too far afield, I promise. So on the one hand, IP rights are, by definition, limited monopolies. But they are legal monopolies. And as you see, if you hopefully did the reading, the Justice Department, which shares enforcement power with the Federal Trade Commission, so you have the antitrust guidelines for the licensing of intellectual property, this is on page 816 of the book, jointly issued in 95 by the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission, note that even though intellectual property is itself, that is, intellectual property rights, are themselves monopolies, notice what the general principles on 817. For the purpose of antitrust analysis, right, the idea of anti-competitive combinations, the agencies regard intellectual property as being essentially comparable to any other form of property. The agencies do not presume that intellectual property creates market trust, market power, excuse me, in the antitrust context. And the agencies recognize that intellectual property licensing allows firms to combine complementary factors of production and is generally pro-competitive. So intellectual property protection potentially has anti-competitive, although by definition it is a limited time, limited scope, anti-competitive. And because one can always invent something else, it isn't nearly as anti-competitive as some other things. So the Justice Department and the FTC say, you know what? Intellectual property rights per se, they're just property rights for this purpose. We're not going to make any assumption that because someone has an IP right, it is anti-competitive. We're also not going to assume that there is market power because there are other ways of doing things. And if you go in the analysis, that's essentially what it says. Yes, they can, someone with an IP right can keep others from doing this and can keep it from the market, but there's other ways of getting to the same market under IP rights. But also licensing can be pro-competitive. Licensing can allow products to be sold by more than one company. The inventor doesn't have to be the sole source. The inventor can generate revenue by allowing others, or the creator can generate revenue by allowing others to utilize the work, which will get it to the marketplace. So some kinds of licensing are pro-competitive. So we talked about some of the... this was actually someone who taught this course before I took his... because he was more of an antitrust person than I. So I really want to focus on this, though. Because you have to understand where the problems lie. And the problems come up in licensing as well. And the problems come up in IP rights as well. So we see, for example, you talk about cable companies. What's the big news of the last few weeks, the last few months? Comcast, Time Warner, right? Comcast, Time Warner. What's the obvious problem there, besides the fact that neither company has particularly good customer service? Comcast wins the worst customer service of the year award frequently. The consumer's blog gives it out as the golden poop. But anyway, I don't know. I've never dealt with either Comcast or Time Warner Cable, but I haven't heard good things. But what's the problem?
They're the only companies that are much.
They are essentially right? Big company plus big company makes humongo company. And at some point, humongo company, especially one with rights of access to markets, right? So if your choices were Comcast or Time Warner in a particular market, there went your choice. And the other thing is, if you're a broadcaster and Comcast Time Warner says to you, we don't want you to provide your network to Fios, but you know, we want to do. But if you go to Fios, we won't buy you. We're not going to provide your network to our subscribers, of which we have 150 million. So the size is significant. If, and right now, Comcast and Time Warner are trying very hard to convince regulators, because this merger doesn't happen unless both the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission permit it to happen. They're trying to convince everyone that no, we're not going to take away competition in the marketplace. We're both really small. There are other choices. Sometimes that works. Sometimes that works. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes they will permit a merger, but only if certain parts of the merged companies then get sold off. So that it's not 1 + 1 = 2. It's 1 + 1 = 1.5, and then a half goes away to some other provider. But you also see these issues coming to the fore in IP licensing and IP rights, especially in telecom providers and telecom device providers. You see licenses and enforcement of IP rights being used to either squash competition among cell phone providers. I mean, how many billions of dollars right now is Apple fighting with Samsung over, and they're, you know, back in court now? Or you have company A sues company B countersues company A, maybe they'll grant licenses. Google licenses Android to everybody, but only if you're willing to share data. A license is not independent. Licenses can have pro or anti-competitive features. IP rights can have pro or anti-competitive features, and often the monopoly nature of a proposed combination, that the monopoly nature is because of IP rights. That there's, it's not about the physical assets of the combined company, it's the intellectual property rights of the combined company and how they will be able to keep others from getting access to them. And the courts sometimes force companies mandatory licenses at market rates in order to permit competition. So just, that's rain. Okay. So the ceiling's not particularly well soundproof, but at least it appears for the moment to be waterproof, which is good. So just to give you a sense of the types of things that can come up, and the reason I want to talk about this is not only because IP rights are monopolies, but because these are concepts that underlie a lot of things that your clients are going to try to do. And sometimes what seems to be a great idea for your client, you know, may turn out to be illegal because of the anti-monopoly and antitrust rules. So what are the kinds of things that come up in these types of cases? So really, the two ways of looking at it that people use are horizontal and vertical. Horizontal arrangements, meaning you've got two or more companies at the same level. So two or more telecom providers, two or more oil companies, two or more gas stations, whatever it is, they are at the same part in the retail or the business chain. And so if they collaborate in anti-competitive ways, it can be deemed illegal. So you have things like price fixing. we're not going to fight with you. Let's keep our both of us agree, or all of us agree, to keep our prices high. You know what we call that? We call that a cartel. In other countries, cartels are legal, which is why you have OPEC. Right? OPEC is a cartel of oil-producing countries that all agree that they're going to sell for the same per barrel price. And it's a hugely powerful cartel. It does all sorts of things to the world economy. And it's only when you have other oil-producing countries. Yeah. I don't know how OPEC is arranged, but it's awfully effective, however it's done. So you see the power of anti-consumer monopolies, right? OPEC is a prime example, but it doesn't fall under our laws, so we can't do anything about it, except produce energy and compete with OPEC. That's how we fight that as a country. But you have price fixing. It can be gas stations. It can be airlines. Frequently, it's airlines. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't see the same prices. It's an amazing thing that airline A raises its prices and airline B, 5 minutes later, raises its prices for the same markets. They may not necessarily be collaborating. That's illegal. They may simply be following the leader, right? If the market's going to bear it, we'll all go up. But if the market comes down, we'll all go up. So it's only when they get together to do it that it's a problem for the law. It can be a problem for people buying, but you can't, if it's not collusion, right, if it's not a conspiracy, it's simply one business deciding it's not going to compete on price. It doesn't have to. It's not good for consumers, but it's not illegal. Market division. You take that territory, we'll take that territory. Or we're going to keep this market, we're going to fight everybody else. You know, we'll allow each other to be here. Group boycotts. That supplier has gotten too uppity. That supplier. So all of us that buy from that supplier, we're going to stop buying from that supplier. We're going to put it out of business. So you can actually have Or we're not going to sell to this person. You could have them going up or down and hurting competition. Monopoly, we talked about. Monopsony, I love this word. I don't look it up to remind myself. Anyone know what monopsony means? What's the opposite of a monopoly? Monopoly is a single seller. So what's monopsony? Single buyer. You aren't allowed to exercise your sole buyer. You are the one place that everybody goes. So, you know, you're not allowed to do that to hurt competition either. And mergers. Mergers particularly, when you have two big companies become bigger company, they might be too big for competition. Then you have vertical arrangements within this. So it's not companies of the same place in the business cycle. But it's, if you think about it, companies within the chain, manufacturer, wholesaler, retailer, etc., or maybe parts suppliers, manufacturer, or distributors, manufacturer, but like this chain. So you can have resale price maintenance. You, retailer, in order to keep up the perceived market value and also to preserve our profits, you're not allowed to sell for less than X. That's illegal. Suggested retail price is not. Mandated retail price is. Territorial allocation. I'm going to grant you this and you that. But you, I'm not going to let sell my product. Vertical integration. I'm going to buy my suppliers, and I'm going to buy my distributors. We're all going to be one big happy company, but that means that we have much greater control over the pricing along the way, so the consumer will not be able to get things from other right? These suppliers can't sell to other manufacturers. These distributors can't buy from other manufacturers. We're just going to lock in the chain, reduce the choices for consumers. Exclusive dealing, I'm only going to deal with this company, put those out of business. And then tying. Tying is a particularly is relevant in IP licenses. Because as we've seen, a license is only as good as the rights last. Right? Once the patent is expired, there's no license to be had. But what if you can leverage your legal monopoly to help sell something that isn't protected? If you want a license to my patented product, or you want to buy my patented an example of my patented invention from me, I'm only going to sell it to you if you also buy these other things from me and nobody else. You want to buy my printer? You have to buy my ink or my paper. And I'm not going to sell you my printer, which I have an exclusive right to, unless you also buy these other things that you could get from somewhere else. That's illegal. Using the legal monopoly power to force customers to also buy non-monopoly protected goods from you. Doesn't mean you're not allowed to sell them, but it means you're not allowed to tie their ability to purchase or license from you your unique thing to forcing them for the other things. Now, companies try to get around this technically, right? They'll say, well, we're not going to force you to buy our toner cartridges, but we're going to make it so our printers only work with our toner cartridges. Technical. If they have the ability technically to do that, that's fine. But then you see all sorts of entrepreneurial people that learn to refill toner cartridges, right? So that even if the physical toner cartridge must be the original one, the stuff inside, so you don't have to buy toner cartridges from HP, you can refill the ones that you bought once. And that's how, but HP can't prohibit you from selling toner cartridges if they're not themselves protected. Of course, you have the legal issues. Anytime you have one of these cases, the standard way out of the scope of this class in terms of what represents an illegal monopoly, what represents an illegal trust, making sure that there is interstate commerce involved, because otherwise the federal courts, federal law has no jurisdiction, whether private litigants have standing, etc. Lots of stuff that's well out of the scope, but understand that, like all other cases, you've got to deal with these kinds of issues here. So I want to at least introduce to you, in the last few minutes, a couple of situations where these issues can come up in the IP context. So you know that Coca-Cola keeps its formula separate, right? It doesn't release its formula. What intellectual property protection does Coca-Cola maintain for its secret formula? It's not a patent. It's a trade secret, right? Which doesn't mean they don't tell anybody. It means that they tell people only if they are bound by confidentiality. So Coca-Cola has one way of doing it is only owning all of its bottling plants, right? So vertical, right, integration. But that means that nobody can get Coke at a competitive price, whatever Coke, and nobody can bottle it for less and sell it for less. So issues of forcing Coca-Cola to work with independent bottling companies and license the formula to them in order that consumers have a shot at having affordable, right? Otherwise, if Coke controls the whole thing, people want it. They could charge $59 a bottle, wholesale, and then the retailers won't have much room to mark it up. The only way to adjust that pricing is for the bottlers, who are the wholesalers, to be able to compete on price.
So that's still an issue, even though there's other, pool of competition out there?
I'm not saying it's illegal, but if the company has, right, the integration, and it's a particularly wanted product, yeah. And then, of course, especially when they have exclusive access to, you know, so we went from a Coke shop last year to a Pepsi shop this year in the cafeteria because the caterer had whichever deal. I'm not a big fan, but there it is. That's why that happens. So if you allow them to have exclusive rights to a restaurant, right, then all the more so, if the restaurant has to buy the product, then you have to allow the restaurant to find price competitive or stores or whatever. So Microsoft, yeah.
I just said, well, I would think the restaurant has a choice in going with whatever supplier they want, right?
Assuming there are multiple suppliers.
And they're gonna go with,
right, but if the only bottling company in the neighborhood is owned by Coke, and everybody else, because it's expensive to buy a bottle, make to build a bottling plant, right? If the bottling plant is the only allowed to bottle for Coke, then it's going to hurt the consumer's ability to get products. So again, not that it's illegal, but understand these issues when you have that kind of a vertical thing. Microsoft licensing its operating system to an original equipment manufacturer. Dell, I was going to say Gateway. Dell, Lenovo, HP, Sony, Asus. So Microsoft has a huge amount of potential power over how it prices its operating systems. Whether, in fact, it allows Dell to sell Windows machines. Right? Microsoft could say, no, I don't want to work with Dell. I only want to work with HP. And Dell will have a real problem. So Microsoft has that level of power. And we see from the reading, one of the other places Microsoft has had power is to say, okay, so we have Windows, the operating system. We also have a browser. So we're going to so integrate Internet Explorer into our browser, into our operating system, that nobody else is going to go. There were other browser companies, Netscape being one of them, that were trying to sell to computer manufacturers to bundle to put onto the device. And computer manufacturers were saying, well, look, Internet Explorer is already there. Why should we bother paying for more? And that was essentially what you see in the Microsoft antitrust case, because it had the power of the thing it wanted to keep companies from buying competitors' products as well. You've got hugely valuable toys, characters. Do you allow multiple toy companies? Do you only work with one and keep everybody else out? Satellite radio. How many satellite radio companies are there?
Two.
Nope. One. How is it that Sirius was allowed to buy XM? That was not by any means easy. When neither one was doing all that well, Sirius was doing a little bit better. Sirius says, okay, we're going to buy XM. The only two companies in the space. And it goes through. It took a while, but it went through. How did it go through? Anybody know? Anyone study that? How do you define the market? If you define the market as satellite radio, then clearly you've gone from 2 to 1. Completely anti-competitive, anti-choice in the economic sense. But if you successfully, as they did, define the market as music in cars, then they are competing not with each other, but with portable devices and terrestrial radio and CD players and all the other ways people listen to things in cars. And that was the successful argument, which is why now you have no choice in satellite radio. It may have one brand or the other, but they are the same company. But that was a significant antitrust issue that had to do not only with physical assets, but intellectual property assets, because they had contracts with particular providers of content. Right? Sirius had exclusives, XM had exclusives. So now, if you want, right, there's only one company to deal with. So if you're a radio person, or you know, you can't try to get a better deal from the other satellite company. There isn't one anymore. So I'm going to post these slides. You can just see some of these things. But a reminder, tomorrow's class, we're going to talk some about bankruptcy. Take any questions you may have. Look for the online instructions. Drive safely and have a good night.
Microsoft was a
time
issue, right? With the IE, the Windows, the IE.
It was not only was it sort of an economic time. Let me turn this off. Hold on.